Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig. If you like this show and you want to support it and you want to keep it free, head on over to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/support. If you're a business owner and you want to increase your cash flow, or if you're a label or artist and you want to promote new music, then listen up. For information about advertising on Everyone Loves Guitar, including information on geographically targeted ads, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. If you want to buy or sell a home or investment property and you're here in the Tampa Bay area, in Hillsboro, Pinellas, or Pasco counties, then listen up. West Florida Real Estate is a local residential real estate broker that's helped over 250 Bay Area homeowners buy and sell their properties in the last 4 years alone. If you're looking to sell, you'll want to get their free report, The 7 Biggest Mistakes Homeowners Make When Hiring a Realtor. And if you're looking to buy a property, you definitely want to get your hands on The 21 Most Expensive Mistakes Tampa Home Buyers Make When Buying a Home. Each one of these reports is going to save you time and money. Inside, you'll discover the 7 most important things to consider when hiring a realtor, what to do if you're buying and selling a home at the same time, and the danger of choosing a realtor who agrees with everything you say. To get your hands on these free reports, head on over to westfloridarealestate.com. That's westfloridarealestate.com. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And before I introduce my next guest, I want to just tell you a little story how I wound up getting together with him. So a few weeks ago, I interviewed Matt Beck, who played with Rod Stewart like in the last 5 years sometime. And when I was talking to Matt's out of New York City, and I was talking to Matt, and I said, hey, you know, my favorite Rod Stewart song is I Was Only Joking. It's from like 1977, and it's literally got, to me, one of the most just beautiful solos in it. It's just, I mean, every time I hear it, I melt. It's gorgeous. I said, did you guys ever play that? And he said, no. For some reason, Rod only plays that when he's in Europe, or even England, I think he said. And we went to England once, and I had to miss that tour. I had to call a sub in, so I missed that. And so it got me thinking. I got off the call, and I'm like, man, I'd love to find the guy who did that solo and get him on here, because he's in my DNA. He has impacted me at such a guttural level emotionally, and just made me feel so many things. And I've listened to that solo literally hundreds of times, and now I learned how to play it. And I said, I wonder if I could find him. So I started doing some research, and it wasn't really crystal clear who did it. And I found this guy online who's a brilliant session player out of England named Jim Cregan. And I looked and I said, man, I don't know if 100% that's him, but let me take a wild shot and see if I could reach out to him. And sure enough, Jim was kind enough to get back to me, and it was him. So today we have the wonderful Jim Cregan, who's got more stories than a Hans Christian Andersen storybook. And he's a lovely guy, lives in the south of England, and I'm really excited to talk to him. So Jim, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate this. It's really exciting for me.
Hey, Craig, it's my pleasure.
Let me tell people about your background, and then we'll dig into it. Jim's early work with Blossom Toes, Family, Linda Lewis, Cat Stevens, and Cockney Rebel eventually led him to join a new band started by Rod Stewart after the Faces broke up. He was with Rod for 18 years as his band leader, co-writer, and co-producer. Together, they wrote such songs as Tonight I'm Yours, Forever Young, Passion, and Brighton Beach, which came from Rod's number one album, Time. Jim has 3 ASCAP awards for outstanding songwriting and has co-written 30 songs with Rod. In the mid-90s, Jim left the road and he returned to writing and producing with credits ranging from Willie Nelson, Kid Rock, Gypsy Kings, Joe Cocker, amongst many others. And he also formed a band called Farm Dogs with Bernie Taupin, releasing two LPs. Of course, Bernie Taupin from Elton John fame wrote all the hits with Elton. Jim toured and played on Katie Melua's first two albums. Both of those albums reached number one. He's played on over 50 gold and platinum records to date. In 2011, he started Creative Music Management and Cocomac Records while developing a new artist called Charlie Hole. In 2012, Jim started his own band called Cregan & Company with Ben Mills on vocals. And this band is featured in Kenny Jones' Hurtwood Park Polo Club Prostate Cancer Charity Concerts, playing on stage with The Who, Jeff Beck, Midge Ure, Mike Rutherford, Paul Carrack, Steve Harley, and loads of other great artists. Bringing things full circle, in September 2015, Jim joined Rod on stage for the first time in 21 years at the BBC's concert in Hyde Park to play this memorable guitar solo that he created in I Was Only Joking before an audience of 55,000 people. And I would encourage you to stop for a minute, write this down, go to YouTube and look up Jim Cregan, C-R-E-G-A-N, and Rod Stewart, and I Was Only Joking. It's a really cool video, especially for me. It just brought back years of nostalgia. In 2018, saw a collaboration between Jim and The Side Deal, which is a band formed by Charlie Collin, two-time Grammy-winning songwriter for Train, who's coming on this show soon, funny enough. The song called The One That Got Away forms part of Jim's commitment to a charity that he's extremely heavily involved with called Angel Force USA. And we'll talk about that later. And this charity helps prevent veterans with post-traumatic stress syndrome from continuing to commit suicide. And this is a pretty serious problem. I don't know if you know any veterans, you're probably aware of it, but it's roughly 20 vets a day kill themselves from the experience they've had with PTSD. And I don't, just to get off topic for a second, I've had a good buddy who served in the Middle East for years, and he was totally fucked up when he came back. And, but you know, it was really tragic. And the services that the armed forces provide for these guys is really pretty shitty in comparison to the burden of what they took on their shoulders and what they gave in return. So it's just really not fair. Anyway, Cregan and Company will be performing at a series of gala events here in the States during the coming year. The first effort was in December 1st of last year in Newport Beach, and they raised $200,000 for Angel Force USA. Jim's charity work continues with a new concert alongside Kenny Jones scheduled for September, and he's got a new book called And On Guitar coming out in June. Jim, not bad for a little kid from South England somewhere. Shit, man. This is pretty
I forgot to mention that that thing that's going on with Kenny Jones next on September, I just since I talked to you about this, having this interview, I spoke to Rod and he's agreed that he's going to come and sing with us.
Oh, so
it's
wow.
Mostly it's my band with Kenny Jones on drums. And of course, the next call would be to Ronnie Wood, see if he's free, and then we'll have a 40-minute set for this charity.
Wow, man!
And it's prostate cancer, which both Kenny and I have had, and Rod's had a scare with it too. So we're all we're all old guys, and it's a pretty tricky disease. And I'm always telling people, if you're 50 or over, go and get a blood test and find out if you're at risk.
Yeah.
That's how my life got saved.
With PSAs?
So anybody, all you guys listening, just go get your PSA level checked. It's just a blood test. It's simple.
Thanks, man.
And it's the difference between living and dying.
Thanks, man. That's really important stuff.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Honest. Yeah.
Wow, man.
So I'm still here. That's because of that. Anyway, let's get on to the fun stuff.
Yeah. Well, thank you, man. Hey, so how'd you get your very first gig, and how'd you even wind up in the music business in the first place?
Well, like a lot of kids how old was I, 13 or something? I started out with the reason I'm considered more of a soloist than a necessarily all-round guitar player is because when I was about 11, my uncle gave me a ukulele with one string on it. So chords were not necessarily that easy.
So
I loved playing this thing, and I would just run up and down the neck picking out melodies, and I found it really interesting. And eventually we got the rest of the strings and everything. But I wanted a guitar for Christmas, and I wanted an Elvis Presley plastic guitar, which had a kind of a box that went over the top of the fingerboard, and it had buttons on it. And when you press down a button, you got an A minor, and you press down another one, you got a G. Mm-hmm. And I thought this was really cool. You know, I wouldn't have to bother learning how to play the bloody thing. So just put buttons. Right? So this seemed like a great idea. Only the thing is, it didn't show up in time. The mail order failed. And at the last minute, my dad went out and bought a Spanish guitar and gave me that. And thank God for the postal service being rubbish.
Yeah.
Because that was then the real thing. I was, you know, I picked it up and I haven't put one down since.
That's amazing,
man. That's, you know, 50 years ago or so.
That's a great story.
And then, you know, I started a band at school and played little gigs in the youth clubs and pubs and, you know, just like any other kid. But the difference between me and my mates, though, was that I was really smitten. I wasn't just interested in playing the guitar. I was devoted to it. I mean, my father used to lock the guitar away in a closet until I'd finished my homework. So I'd dash through my homework and get my hands on it. And then I would be in the dining room. We come from a very modest house, but the mum and dad would be in the living room, you know, around the fire watching TV. And I'd be in the freezing cold in the dining room because we didn't have central heating in those days.
Wow.
I'd just keep my coat on and practice and practice and practice and practice and practice.
It's funny that how times have changed, because nowadays if like a kid was smitten by guitar, there's so much, you know, horrible shit out there, or like, you know, the internet or the cell phone or, you know, doing drugs or whatever. You'd like beg him to just, okay, great, sit in your room and play guitar all day, you know? It's funny how, you know, things change.
Well, you know, my son, Mackenzie Cregan, he's studying at the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts, which is Paul McCartney's place up in Liverpool. And he's like me. I mean, at one point, if we're coming back from, you know, when he comes to stay here, because I'm about 200 miles away, he comes down here for the weekend. We go down to the shops and get some groceries and walk in, you know, I open the front door and we've got a couple of bags. Mackenzie is up and has picked up one of my guitars and is playing before I've got the stuff out of the car. He just can't leave it alone.
That's really cool. I would imagine being your son is probably not a bad deal if you're into playing guitar. You probably have.
No, it's great. It's one of the great joys of my life is sitting around playing with him.
Yeah, that must be really nice.
It's just absolutely brilliant. Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Very cool.
He's a great player. Yeah, he came and played with me. I put a band together for a gala in. I find myself doing these a lot of these kind of $1,000 a plate dinners, black tie dinners. Mm. For some reason, I seem to be one of those go to guys. Can you put a band together? You know, I got Kenny Jones to play on one of these gigs, and Mackenzie, my son, came and played second guitar, and he was really fierce. Kenny loved it.
That must be so rewarding to play.
Yeah, he's 20 at the time, but he's been playing since he was three.
That's great,
you know,
man.
He's had a guitar in his hands, you know, like me, you know, I didn't start till I was 12.
Wow, very cool, man. So let me ask you, I'm going to go through some of the artists you've played with, and if you could talk about how you first what was the serendipity involved to get that connection going, and then any cool or interesting stories about working with them, and I'm sure you got hundreds. And let's start with Rod.
Okay. Let's see. Rod, I was touring the States in a British band that were doing really, really well. We had a number one record, a number one single, number one album in the UK and all over Europe. We were trying to get a break in America. It didn't really happen, but still we were opening for the Kinks. And we had a night off in LA and we played the Roxy. We headlined the Roxy. And it was, you know, it was a good turnout. It's a good club, the Roxy. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's, you know, it's a really nice, it's a proper serious grown-up rock club. And Rod came to see us because I guess, you know, there was didn't have anything better to do that night. But he showed up with Britt Eklund, and there was it caused a huge stir as he walked in because she was so unbelievably beautiful.
Yeah,
I mean, there was heads just you could hear, you know, the bones in people's necks as they twisted their heads quickly to look. And anyway, he kind of liked me while I was playing, and got his tour manager to give me a call, and I went back to England and. Rod was, I think Rod was living in England at the time. No, he wasn't. He was living in LA. Anyway, he's in England. He says, listen, I'm going up the pub. Do you want to meet me up there? So I go over. This is in North London, in Highgate, a pub called The Wrestlers. And he was in all his full football kit because he'd just come from a Sunday afternoon game. And he was driving a lime green Lamborghini.
I think hold on, man. I got give me a minute. So when you got the
football kit, right? And the football kit gets out of the car and the football kit in the Lamborghini. I mean, this is sums up. If there'd been a blonde with him, that would have summed up his entire life.
Was it weird?
I think I was on a Lambretta scooter.
Was it weird getting a phone call from him?
No. I was. You know, I'd already been knocking around with some fairly famous people by the time Rod called. Okay. I always liked Rod. I always thought he was great. I really liked his voice.
Yeah.
And, of course, every red-blooded guitar player in England thought the Faces were the best thing. Mm. We just loved those guys. But anyway, so I meet him, and he shows me this trick that he said. There's two tricks he showed me. One was – you bend down to tie your shoelace as you go into the pub, so all the other people get to the bar first and they can order. Right? And then they'll say, what do you want, Rod?
This is great, man.
The other trick he showed me was just ask people what they want. You know, what do you want to drink? And then just don't bother getting them a drink. Just get your own drink. He says they think you've bought them a drink because you asked them what they wanted, but you then pretend you forgot.
It's hilarious.
So, of course,
man.
These tricks then, because – I knew them, and then, of course, the rest of the band knew them. We would all – you'd see us going into the pub, and we'd all stop at the doorway and do our shoes
up. Your shoes. Hilarious, man.
Be pushing people over.
Oh, my God.
You know, he's actually – I mean, this is all kind of fun because he's very generous, especially with me. He's really generous.
Yeah, this is just fun really stuff. Good. Yeah, of course.
It's just mucking about, yeah. So then he said, I'm interested in you being in the band and stuff. And I said, okay, well, you know, I've got a great gig at the moment in Cockney Rebel. So, you know, let me know what you want to do. And I didn't hear from him. I thought, oh, well, you know, that's gone away. Never mind. No, but I loved being in Cockney Rebel. I was making loads of money. We had hit records and we were very tight as a band. In fact, the drummer, Stuart Elliott, still plays in my band from time to time when our regular drummer has to go off and do something else.
That's so cool.
So we go back 40 years, Stuart and I, and he's played with everybody, you know, Eric Clapton, George Harrison, Paul McCartney. You know, he's a really great drummer. Anyway, so I get booked to do a session in LA by Cat Stevens, who's producing this song for my then girlfriend, a girl called Linda Lewis.
Mm.
And so Linda and I fly out to LA. And we go into, I don't know where, I can't remember, Ocean Way or some big studio. And we cut a couple of tracks, and it was a great band. You know, I was seriously fearful of these guys because they were the hottest guys in town. You know, Willie Weeks on bass and Ollie Brown on drums. And what's the guy? Ray Parker Jr. was the other guitar player.
Oh, yeah,
sure. He was a nasty player. I kept trying to copy things off him without him noticing. Anyway, we get the tracks done, and then there's overdubs, and Linda's got to sing, and there's backing vocals, and all stuff has to happen. So I get a couple of days off. I think, oh, because Rod gave me his number in LA, and so I call the number, and he says, and Britt answers the phone.
Mm.
Now I'm impressed. Unbelievably beautiful Swedish film star, so Rod eventually gets on the phone. And says, well, actually, we still need a guitar player and we're rehearsing down the road. You know, do you want to come down and jam? And I said,
whoa.
Yeah. He said, when? I said, now. So I took my guitar and went down and jammed and got the job.
Holy shit. Isn't it weird how things work like that?
Oh, talk about be lucky. Be lucky. Whatever else you do, be lucky. That's the trick.
Wow.
So, So that was the start of the whole unbelievable friendship, which is still going on today.
That is just absolutely amazing, man. I mean, what are the chances you're in LA and you say, "Oh, let me call Rob." Wow. I mean,
yeah, and
shit.
And I'd got some time off and all the rest of it. Yeah, it was great. It was great, and I was the last man in, and the last man out of that lot too. You know, I stayed on much longer than everybody else.
Wow,
so that's
amazing.
That story.
What a fun story. Talk about Bernie. How'd you connect with Bernie Taupin?
Bernie Taupin is not quite as silly as that. I was in a band in England called Family. This is prior to getting into this band, Cockney Rebel. Mm-hmm. Family was a sort of weird, hard rock progressive band with a very unusual singer with a very hard vibrato called Roger Chapman. Huge stage presence, kind of madman, pretty scary. Looked like, you know, he would get down off the stage and beat you to a pulp. he's actually a great guy, but he was very scary looking. And we opened for Elton John, and we did 13 weeks around the States. So that's how I got to know Elton and Davy Johnson and all those guys. And Bernie was on the tour. Bernie was just having fun. You know, he'd written all these songs. I can't remember the record was the one that had, Daniel, my brother, you are older than me, Daniel, and all those, whatever that album was, that was the album they were touring. So it was probably 1975. No, we're earlier than that. 1973, 1972. I'm not very good at dates. Anyway, so Bernie would hang out backstage and we would do our set because Elton John loved Family and wanted to give us a break. That was the whole reason we were on the tour. And so we did a lot of hanging out, and Bernie was backstage, and I'd go back into Elton's dressing room and drink Jack Daniels with Bernie, and we became mates from then on.
Wow.
So when he wanted to start a band. This is much, much, much later. Obviously, I wrote some songs with him. He wrote lyrics on songs for some of Rod's records, and then he wrote. I would have musical ideas lying around, and I'd go to Bernie and say, you know, can you help me finish this song? And he'd give me a lyric. We had lots of that sort of stuff going on. And then we started this band Farm Dogs, but that's quite a lot later on, which was really, really great fun. No promotion, no, you know, record company full of shit, you know, usual stuff.
The fact that you guys would, like, you know, hang out and drink together, I talked to a lot of bands today, loads of guys, obviously, and the headliner, even if they're sort of buddies, they rarely do that. Do you think that's a function of the times, or is that England has always been like that and it's still like that, where they're a little more laid back, or?
I think it's in my experience, having been both the headliner and the support act, it depends entirely on the personalities. Sometimes the personalities of the guys in the support act are so great that you just want to hang out with them, and other times you just don't bother because they don't seem to have anything much that you like about them. But then you got to remember that we were requested to be on this Elton John tour by Elton.
Right.
And so we automatically had kudos, you know. So
yeah.
They wanted to be mates with us, and we were very easy to be friends with. You know, it wasn't any
sure.
A lot of work went into it.
No, I get it. Yeah, that's a different situation. He actually asked you to come on the show, support you. And then let's talk about Joe Cocker.
Well, Joe, I didn't know Joe terribly well. I never did really get to know Joe all that well, but he did come down to the studio. In those days, we would be cutting tracks live. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of a spectator sport. So, we were working in the record plant or Cherokee in Los Angeles, and people would come down and hang, you know. We had a full bar running all the time. You know, there were beautiful blondes all over the place. And the record plant was superbly equipped. It had a jacuzzi room.
Wow. That's crazy. It's a studio.
Yeah. You know, every studio had its own lounge. And When the clubs closed, people would head to the record plant and hang out. There was always some nice band in there.
Oh.
Anyway, Joe came in, and these were the days when he was drinking. And he managed to – we were playing back one of the tracks that was already nearly finished, and we were listening to it, figuring out if we're going to do some different overdubs. And Joe falls into the multi-track machine, right, with a whiskey in his hand.
Oh, my God.
The reel kind of sort of spun backwards and all the rest of it, and everybody kind of gasped because this was, this is our work. And fortunately, there was no damage done to the tape, and Joe was gently escorted out and put in a cab.
Wow.
But the song I got to him was a song called N'oubliez Jamais, which is means never forget. And he had an enormous hit with it all over Europe. It was a number one record. In fact, I probably made more money out of that track than the bestsellers with Rod. It was just because Germany, you get a hit in Germany, they pay really, really well, pay loads better than the States. So, for every time your song gets played on the radio, that was how you got your money in those days. And the record sold, you got more money. It was really good. Having a hit in Germany was really desirable.
Wow, that's amazing.
So then later on I got to hang with Joe when he was doing I was in Katie Melua's band doing a big festival, and he was headlining, and I went and hung out with him in his dressing room, and he sang that song. N'oubliez Jamais. We were in Switzerland, and I was watching the whole show, and I was sitting actually on the side of the stage on a flight case with Katie Melua, who's an absolute delightful woman, just bloody great person. And we're sitting there together watching this, and he goes into my song, and the introduction is on an accordion for some reason, and the whole place stood up and cheered at the intro, and Katie grabbed my arm and gave me a squeeze, and it was one of those really rare moments where somebody's going to do one of your songs and you're just gobsmacked that it's happening, because I'm a huge Joe Cocker fan. He did a great job, and it was one of my very, very favorite moments of listening to somebody play one of my tunes.
Yeah, what a beautiful experience.
Really, yeah, it was great. And I wrote it with Russ Kunkel, the famous drummer.
Was Cliff Goodwin the guitar player then?
Gene Black or Gene, okay. Gene Block, but he called himself Gene Black.
Gotcha.
And he's an old mate of mine. He was lovely. He played nice.
Very cool, man. That's really nice story. Thank you for sharing that.
That's okay.
So I want to talk about that solo you did now, and I was only joking because that's what brought us together originally.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, as I said, I think it's one of the most beautiful solos ever played, and thank you again for creating it, man. It's just had a tremendous impact. The range of emotions it's taken me through. A bunch of questions. Was that pre-written or worked on in any way? So you just did that on the fly in the studio?
Yeah.
You are just fucking kidding me.
No, I'm not. I do all my best work that way.
Shit.
Half the time I don't know what key I'm in. Really, I don't. I just make it up.
Oh, my God. That's amazing, because that's like there's so many things in there that are like unconventional about it. Holy shit.
Yeah, I think I only ever did one solo that I worked out with Rod. And I can't even remember why I worked it out. I think it was probably having trouble getting anything to sound good. So I actually sat down and worked out what I'm supposed to play. But I hate doing that. I love just going for it. And I was talking to somebody about this the other day. Oh yeah, Robbie McIntosh, played with the Pretenders.
Paul.
He was playing in my local pub. It really was. We have a great pub here, a great music pub, and we were having a conversation at the bar, and I said. If I don't get it in three takes, I have to stop because I know that it's not going to get any better. Well, what will happen is it'll get worse and worse and worse for about half an hour, and then it'll come out the other side and it'll start to get better again. But if you want the real good stuff, three takes, stop. And if I haven't got it, then move on and come back, an hour later or the next day or whatever,
I'm absolutely astounded. That is just – so let me ask you – okay, so you have like – this is what – I have. Okay, I got to get my thoughts together here because I cannot believe that you did this shit on the fly. Okay, yeah. So where did you come up with the idea to do like, in my question, it said like flamenco, but you know what I mean? Like the staccato notes on those two or three or four notes. You never hear stuff like that.
Well, I did a famous guitar solo in a Cockney Rebel song. It was number one in England, and it was on an acoustic guitar. And that was the first time I used that technique because obviously you haven't got any sustain on an acoustic, but you want to build tension. And I just accidentally discovered that if I trill on a single note, it creates that effect. You know,
because you can't.
So I'd already done it once, and then Rod said. We were listening to The Year of the Cat.
Mm-hmm. Al Stewart.
Which funnily enough, Stuart Elliott, my sometime drummer, played on that. And the solo in The Year of the Cat morphs from one instrument to the other. It ends up on a saxophone. But what happens is the solo takes off on one instrument and hits a note, and that note sustains through, and then the next instrument takes that note, and the solo goes on from there. I think I've got it right. It might be Baker Street, or it might be, anyway. So we loved this idea. We said this is a cool idea. Let's. What should we do? Shall I take an acoustic solo and then it'll go into, soprano sax or something else? And then we said no. Let's tell you what. Let's go from acoustic to electric. So all I had to do was halfway through the solo, I had to sustain a note that would be the note that the next instrument would come in on. That's all I had to do. So that was the only brief, play a solo and finish on one note and then start the next solo on it.
Man,
so
that's
what
happens
where the electric guitar comes in. So obviously the second guitar is dropped in on top of it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't particularly hard work. I got to be honest. I mean, I have the ability to not care. I don't care about making a mistake.
Yep.
I don't really know what I'm doing. I don't have any preconceived idea of where the notes are going to come from. They just come out. It's a bit like having a conversation. You don't know what you're going to say next. It just comes out. And that's how it is musically for me on pretty well every occasion. So sometimes I can crash and burn. I really can crash and burn, but I don't really care because all the good stuff you're going to get is when you're not thinking. Thinking is, to me, is the thing that kills the creativity. If I have to work out, if I have to think about what all the chords are as I'm playing something, I'm not going to play well because I need to be just off in the zone.
Wow. So some more questions. After you nailed that solo, did you know it was good? Did you like say, man, this was a special moment we just had here?
No, I was pleased with it. I mean, we're all pleased. We all said, okay, we got that. That's good. That's what we're doing next. There was one of those, you don't have time to, first of all, because it's your own work, you don't recognize what effect it's going to have on people. And I think a bit like listening to a record, I can recognize what my records are like about 6 or 7 years after I've made them. I can see, okay, well, that's what that was about. I think at the time, you're just, this is what we do. We make records. So just go make a record.
Wow. Is that one of your favorite solos you've ever laid down?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
it is.
That is one of my favorites. I've got a story about that.
Yeah, man, go ahead. Spill the beans.
I'm being interviewed by my friend Steve Harley, from Cockney Rebel. He's a singer and everything, and he's got his own radio show on the BBC. And it's quite a big show, and he gets me in there, and we're talking, and he says to me, what solos? Are you pleased with it? I said, well, the solo in I Was Only Joking, I really quite liked it because I liked the way it went from acoustic to electric and, it was kind of cool. And he said, okay, let's play that. And they hadn't checked the record or anything because this was taken from the greatest hits, right? Rod Stewart's greatest hits. So they'd squeezed, this is vinyl days, right? They'd squeezed 22 tracks on here. And one of the ways they squeezed 22 tracks on it was to cut the guitar solo in half.
Oh, my God. Oh, so my God.
We get to the guitar solo, and I'm breaking up. I go, what's happened? I butchered it.
Oh, man.
Record companies. That guitar solo doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. Wow.
So when the singer talks about, you know, it's always the vocal and it's always the lyric that counts.
Sure.
So I just say to him, I'm just going to use one word. Beethoven.
So
let's just give me some of those Beethoven lyrics again.
Yeah, right. I have a nerd question for you. I've worked the solo out, and like on the record, it's in, I think, like B flat major, I think.
You know, funny, after you said that, I went and checked. It's in B flat. Yeah, it's in B flat, but it's played in A.
Right.
So I don't know what I did. Did I tune the guitar? A semitone higher to play it?
Did you capo it up maybe?
No, I didn't capo it up. No, because the fingering. It's definitely, I play it in A. So the only thing I can think of is that I tuned the guitars. I tuned the guitars up so I can play it in A. Because Gary Granger wrote the beautiful kind of descending chord sequence, and the arpeggios that I play have got some open strings in it, you know, an open B going on. And it's not difficult, but it's a kind of a bit of an annoying like a 4-fret stretch, you know, to get the right fingering on it. So definitely, it was in A. Yeah. And it starts off in C. There's another sort of that kind of crazy stuff. Let's play the intro in C and then let's play the song in A. Just for why? Why? Well, because we can.
Well, you know what? As a guy still learning guitar, I learned a lot from that solo because I saw how many of the notes were directly from the scale. And, you know, I'm still at that stage where I'm learning to play chord changes and stuff. So I was like, wow, this was so educational because everything worked. It was perfect. It's like, you know, like when you break a Gilmour solo down, you often find that, you know, he's playing arpeggios and it. Same thing. And that, to me, those are actually the most beautiful sounding solos.
Well, I do think that you should be able to sort of hum a solo. I don't think there's a lot of advantage in playing something that is so, well, I got to caution myself here because, you know, Jeff Beck can get away with all that stuff because
Jeff Beck.
He just does it so right. But generally speaking, and Eddie Van Halen, I like his playing too. I think he's wonderful. Hmm. But mostly guys that flail about playing as many notes as they can. And I have been one of those guys in my past because I thought that was, you know, that was clever and it's actually rubbish. But so I don't do any of that anymore. I mean, I hardly ever play anything that a guy's been playing for a few years couldn't play. But hopefully the way I play it, it will give it the intensity and maybe the emotion that comes from being, you know, from playing for 50 years or so. But I'm a big fan of keeping it simple.
Well, it's a beautiful. Anything else you remember about that, or anything else you'd like to say about that track or your solo in it?
No, I think that about covers it. I played it on my fabulous Martin D18, which is the best D18. It's probably the best Martin I've ever played, and I bought it in London for £250.
Wow.
Which was a lot of money in those days.
Sure.
And it's my favorite guitar. I've had a D45, I've D28s, D35s, all sorts of wonderful Martin dreadnoughts, and none of them are anything like as good as this guitar. It's bizarre.
And what was the electric that you played it on?
I think I played it on a white SG with patent applied force. No, with soap bar. P90s.
Interesting.
Yeah, black, white. I think so. Yeah, that's right. I'm sure I'm right. Yeah. An SG, white SG.
And then when you played it, you know, a few years back on stage and with front of those 55,000, you had a, I don't know if it was a Strat, but it was a Strat style guitar.
Yeah, it's made by a friend of mine and it's got a piezo in it. And so okay. I play the first part of it on the piezo, and then I have a, you know, foot switch where I kick in the amp and overdrive. You know, so
very cool.
So I can do it myself. So it's it kind of works.
Yep. That's what I've been when I've been playing it. I've been playing it on my Strat, like in the second position, I think, and then you know just kicking on the distortion in a little bit of dirt once it switches over. Thank you. I learned a lot. When you just that was a great what you just explained to me as another way of building up tension, and then with the other, that was really educational. Thank you, man. That was really cool.
Okay. Well, you're welcome.
Wow. Okay. So, what would you say are the top, if you can even, as you always say, you know, as I've read your stuff, you know, what a life. What are the top three experiences you've had musically for whatever reason? The work you did, the personalities involved, any reason at all?
Okay. Well, there's rather a lot. So these are just the random ones that fell into my head today. The Stewart Band played Wembley Stadium, which is the home of the football cup. You know, this is the, I don't know what it is, the Super Bowl.
Like the Super Bowl, right?
Right. So this is the place, Wembley Stadium. It's no longer, they knocked it down, they built another one. I haven't played the new one, but the old one was really, really big in everybody's kind of places to play. And we played that to a very big crowd. And then at the end of when we were very close to finishing, on came Kenny Jones, Ronnie Woods, Ian McLagan, and Ronnie Lane. Ronnie Lane was, because he's got multiple sclerosis. So he was replaced by Bill Wyman from Rolling Stones.
Sure.
And they played two songs, and then the whole band played another couple of tunes. So I was jamming with the Faces at Wembley Stadium. All my family were there, and everything. It was just one of those days. It was just fantastic. And the lovely manager then, because he was, you know, because he's not very rock and roll, and in fact is one of the least rock and roll people you'll ever meet.
You mean Rod's manager?
He's terrible. He's a very strange human being. Anyway, he decided in his wisdom that the backstage passes, in order to get to the party, would have to have a little silver star that he was dishing out. And it would go into the corner of this backstage part. So Arnold would come around and give you a little star that made you could go to the party. Well, of course, Ronnie didn't have one. Keith was there. He didn't have one. So we go.
Probably went over
We go to the party. And there's the band. And I had to fight to get my family in because they didn't have them. And there's about 30 people in this room for about 120 or more.
Wow.
And Rod's going, "Where's all our guys? Where's all the mates? Where's all the people who got the backstage pass?" I could see Arnold sort of slinking off in the corner, and we're all going, "Arnold." I mean, Keith couldn't get
that's
in.
Really a strange thing for a rock and roll manager to be so uptight.
He's
like that.
He's not a rock and roll manager. No, he manages Rod Stewart, but he's not a rock and roll manager.
Yeah, strange. All right, so Rod Stewart with the Faces at Wembley. What else?
Yeah, okay. Jamming with Frank Zappa when I was in Blossom Toes. This was very young. I was about 23. And my band, well, it's not my band, our band, Blossom Toes, had a twin lead guitar business going on, me and a guy called Brian Godding. And we were the first British guys to do harmony lead guitar. You know, at the same time as a band called Spirit, who had come up with it over in America. But we didn't know about them because that record hadn't made it to our shore yet. But it did, you know, within the next year or so, it did. But Brian and I invented this style of harmony guitar, which Wishbone Ash happily tell us. And so, and the same, they're quite on it. They're quite honest about it. They pinched it off us. Anyway, we're doing this show, and Frank was the master of ceremonies, and he had his rig on a little rolling riser thing, and he didn't tell you if he was going to jam. He just kind of wheeled this rig out onto your bit of the stage, and said, "Hey, well, guys, I'm just going to jam," and we were just, "Oh man!" So there's Frank and Brian and me in a row, swapping 8 bars across the stage. And I was, and it's a big festival. I don't know, I would say, you know, 30,000 people maybe. And I was in heaven because Frank has been one of my heroes forever. I mean, not only is he, not only do I love his playing because it's so bizarre, he's so different.
Yes,
but also his writing. I mean, I saw the Mothers of Invention right in the beginning when they were just starting out, and they were amazing, absolutely amazing.
That's very cool, man.
Yeah, he's good. So that's the second one, and then there's a couple of small ones like when I was in a little band, pretty well just out of school. We were friends with a guy called Giorgio Gomelski, who ran the Marquee Club.
He managed the Yardbirds.
Managed the Yardbirds and managed my band too, managed the Blossom Toes. And but this was before I was in Blossom Toes. It was a little blues band I was in. And Giorgio would be involved in bringing over these blues artists and overcame Howlin' Wolf and Hubert Sumlin. And Giorgio suggested that my little band should be the backing band to play this one gig. I think they probably had a regular, more grown up band than us, but we had this one gig in London, and I got to play Smokestack Lightning with Howlin' Wolf and Hubert Sumlin, and I was like, okay, this pinch myself now.
I mean, cool.
A spotty 20-year-old kid. You know, and I'm playing with these guys, and I didn't know how to address Howlin' Wolf because his name is Chester Burnett.
Oh, so do you call him Mr. Wolf, Mr. Burnett?
No, that was thing. Yeah. See, I didn't know what to call him. So I'm fretting over this in the dressing room. The dressing room was the kitchen of this pub. It was an upstairs room in a pub, and I'm thinking he's going to come in a minute. Now, what am I going to say? Mr. Wolf, hello, Howlin'. That doesn't sound right.
that's a very British thing. Like, I could see you freaking. I know because my wife is British, I told you. So that's a very British thing where I'd see you guys freaking out.
Yeah, you don't want to get this wrong. You know, he's going to give you a filthy look, and then the gig's going to be wrecked. And fortunately, he walked into the room, and he just smiled, and he held his hand down. And he said, hey, I'm Chester Burnett.
Oh, very cool.
Chester, thanks. Hey, man, I'm Jim. And he said, he looked at the band and we said, are we going to rehearse anything? He says, I know you boys know how to play the blues.
Now, that's classic, man.
What a leap of faith.
That is so cool. Man,
we did. We got away with it.
That is so cool. Did you learn anything from playing with those guys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, groove. Ooh, find the groove. Get on the groove. Sit on it. Yeah, of course. Yeah,
very cool.
Absolutely.
Hey man, tell one or two more because this is so interesting.
Well, there's the before the band became the Blossom Toes, we were living in France and we become really very popular in France. We were playing in a club in Paris called the Bus Palladium. This was like the star club of Paris. Mm. We were working there every night of the week. 7 nights a week from that was a bit redundant. From 9 in the evening till 3 in the morning with 45 minutes on, 15 minutes off.
Wow. Amazing that. Wow. That's back in the day when they used to have late shows, man.
This was a great club. This was really fun. And anyway, we then, because people liked us and we would get invited to, after the 3 o'clock, we'd get invited to go and play at somebody's party. So we got invited to, where was it? One of the ones we got invited to was Gunter Sachs' apartment on Avenue Foch. And Gunter Sachs was married to Brigitte Bardot at the time.
Wow.
So that was one of those parties where you just, you know, couldn't get your tongue back in your mouth.
It was drooling.
And we set the gear up in a corner of the living room in this Belle Epoque mansion-y kind of apartment. And all the local guys were going, hey, can we play your instrument? Can we want a jam? Is it okay? We'd say, yeah, sure. So we just played 15 sets. We didn't want to play anymore. So they would play and we'd drink and chat up the girls. It was a great relationship.
Wow. What a great experience as a young man to have that, man.
Oh, it was a great time to be living in Paris. It was fantastic. And so we then got this, our first ever TV show. And it's in a casino in Deauville. Deauville is a very swanky casino and vacation spot. It's the, I don't know, whatever the, it'd be like sort of like a somewhere really cool in Long Island, you know, like mm-hmm. Fire Island or somewhere very, very ritzy.
Very ritzy,
and,
yeah.
The Parisians all go there when they want to go to the beach, right? It's in the north. And so we're behind the curtains, and I've never been so nervous in my life. My knees are actually knocking, right?
Really?
Oh yeah, because we've never been on TV before.
Okay.
And it's a very posh black tie crowd, and the whole band we know what we're going to do. We're rehearsed. We know how to play this stuff, but it's just the waiting behind the curtains. That's always used to upset me. I'm all right with it now, but it used to make me so nervous. And then suddenly the announcement in French and the curtains opened and we went straight into the first song, and there at the table right in front of us was Frank Sinatra.
Holy shit.
I was like, oh God, can you make this any more difficult?
Wow. Well, that's amazing, man. And you're you're a very young kid when you do this.
20, 21, 22, 23, something like that. Wow. Anyway, we got through it, but that was one of those moments, you know.
Wow. Well, such good stories, man. Thank you so much, Jim, for sharing that. Cool. Really, really cool, man. I really love your energy and enthusiasm, because I could feel that it's the same today as it was when you were 21 years old about music, which is really cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's never going to change.
Where did you grow up as a kid?
I grew up pretty well where I am now, in the south of England. It's like, I feel like an old salmon swimming back up, dying up there, up those spawning beds, coming up river. I actually was born in a couple of counties over towards the west, in a place called Yeovil in Somerset. Then when I was about five, we moved to this area, Poole Harbour, which is the, for those geographically inclined, it's the second largest natural harbour in the world, second only to Sydney, Australia.
Oh, very cool.
It's an enormous harbour and beautiful. And I grew up there with boats and, just silly little boats, sailboats and kayaks and, it's all small stuff, but just in love with it. And I now live on the, I live about 10 miles along the coast towards Southampton in a little town called Christchurch. And I live on the River Stour and have a little boat, and I can throw the boat in the water. There's a slipway just right here. Put in the water, go down the river through the natural harbor, which is all protected. It's got wild ponies running along the banks.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not.
Wild ponies, that's got to be gorgeous. Yeah.
Yes, it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And then you arrive at a sandbar, which has got chalet huts on it that you can sleep in. And the family have got a couple of those. And you pull your boat up on the sand and you spend the night there if you want. There's a bar. You can cook in these chalets. And it's absolutely idyllic. Beautiful.
That's great, yeah. Man.
So fortunate. And I've lived all over the world. I lived in Portugal and France and Italy and America for ages, 22 years in Los Angeles and London and Paris. And now I'm here. I'm back.
That's great. The place sounds gorgeous, man. It sounds like you really get to relax and enjoy yourself there.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
What was growing up like? It sounded pretty good from what you earlier described.
Yeah, it was really good. My mother was a housewife, and my father sold. He's a salesman. He sold commercial refrigeration, which the kind of those big kind of chest things that you have in supermarkets, where the butter and milk and things go that you don't. They haven't got doors on. Those kind of things. So he was involved in selling those, and he was a salesman most of his life. But he had a lot of different jobs, He was a self-educated guy, but really, really kind and good fun, and took care of his family. And we didn't have much money, but nobody cared,
Yeah.
I find that to be one of the more interesting things about my life, where it's been all over the place with incredibly wealthy people and people with next to nothing. And I find that most often the people with next to nothing are going to have more fun than the incredibly wealthy people.
Why is that? And,
I think one of the problems that if you have unspeakable amounts of money, you have a high expectation of everything you do. Like, you know, you're staying at the Ritz Hotel in Paris, is one of the finest hotels in the world. And because you're paying, you know, $3,000 a night for a suite, you're going to complain if everything isn't just right. Mm. But if you're staying, you know, you're staying in a tent in a campground, you know, in a forest, you don't care. You're just going to get on. You don't have any of those things to get upset about. I find, and this is not true of all my rich friends.
Sure,
but it's my observation that you can be just as happy with next to nothing. I mean, you've got to have enough money to put shoes on and have a bed and a roof and food and and some kind of car and maybe some disposable cash to go to the pub.
Sure,
but after that, the rest of it's just it doesn't count for much. It really doesn't count for much.
Let me ask you this: what were some of the lower points or bigger obstacles you've had to overcome over your career, and how did you get through them?
Right, low points. The biggest low point that I've had to deal with really is getting prostate cancer, which I got about 6 years ago, maybe, and I'm in remission. The treatment was really successful.
That's great.
It still leaves you with some side effects, but I'm alive. I'm happy. I'm in pretty good shape. But that's not that I didn't have the reaction to having cancer that I thought I was going to have. After the initial shock, actually was very, I got to be quite philosophical about it, and also Kenny Jones was so nice to me during this period. I mean, he's always nice to me, but this particular period, he phoned me every day, asked me how I was doing, what were the results were from the doctor, what was the next, talked me through all the treatments, because we had the same doctor at the same hospital, because we both lived in Surrey.
Hmm.
He was so kind. I will never forget how he helped me through this. He took away a lot of my fears. He said, "You know, you've caught it in time. You're going to be all right." Because there's a little minute or two where you're waiting to find out whether it's spread. You know, that's the tricky moment. And it hadn't spread, so then you're just going to have the treatment. So that was very interesting. And then Kenny and I would go out and do part of some sort of prostate cancer awareness thing, and we would go and do interviews and talk on TV and go to these kind of events to talk about prostate cancer. And Kenny put this thing on every year at Hurtwood Park, his polo club. And one year, I was a co-band leader. There's a guy called Josh Phillips who plays Hammond organ in Procol Harum and is a really, really successful television writer. And he's a very old mate of mine. We're really good mates. And I could see he was struggling being the band leader for this outfit because we'd have to back up, 10 different artists and we have to learn 30 songs. We'd have 3 days rehearsal. It was quite hard work and I could see him struggling with it. And so I said, "Look, I'll co-band lead this with you." And I remember at the end of this concert, I mean, I think the first year we had The Who. So there's us lot up there jamming with Pete and Roger and Kenny,
which was horrible.
Being on stage with Pete Townsend is a really interesting experience.
In what way? Because he's such a fabulous, fabulous creative monster, man.
Man, he is so powerful.
Yeah.
His commitment to playing that guitar is like nothing. Nobody comes anywhere near. Nobody. Hendrix. I've seen Hendrix. Nobody comes anywhere near Pete Townsend's commitment to that instrument. My God, he's fearsome. He's absolutely fearsome. And when you're standing, when he's sort of like, 8 feet away, you catch every nuance of what he's up to. It was amazing. Anyway, at the end of all this thing, we play It's Only Rock and Roll, But I Like It or whatever. And then we're saying goodbye. And I didn't intend to do this and I wasn't expected to do this, but I went to the front of the stage and I said, "Okay," this was said to me some time back now, "All the men here over 50, put your hands up. Right. all those guys that have had their PSA checked, put your hands down. All you guys with your hands up this week, tell me now you're going to go see your doctor, get a blood test.
That was really cool of you, man.
Well, you know, I'm semi-evangelical about it because I've lost friends, you know, who didn't go. They didn't go. And then the time they find it, it's too late. You know,
wow.
They get a couple of years to live and good night.
Oh, man, that's really cool of you that you're participating in this and, you know, kind of paying it back in a way, paying it forward, I guess.
Yeah, there we are. I say I'm one of the lucky ones.
Yeah.
I got away with it. Yeah.
Is there anything, Jim, if you had to go back, like, is there any advice you would have given yourself as a kid that you think would have made your life easier in any way?
Yeah, I think in the time that I was learning how to play the guitar, the electric guitar, there were no lessons. You'd have to learn to play flamenco or classical music, both of which, of course, I now love. But at the time, I wasn't interested. And so I'm completely self-taught, apart from when I was about 40 or 45. I had some lessons in L.A. from some guy. It was really useful. I liked it. It was helpful. But I would advise my early self, I would say, get some lessons. It'll make your ascent to being a competent player much quicker. And also, I would like to learn to read music for voice. I don't necessarily want to learn it for guitar, but I would learn it for voice so that when I have an idea for a melody, I can write it down. And I don't necessarily think that having a lot of really grown-up musical theory would improve my playing. I don't think it would. I'm slightly nervous that it might have undone some of my creativity, because what you don't want to be doing is thinking. It's like you get all this information, you then got to throw it away. The best work is when you're in the zone where you're not thinking about any of the stuff. You don't not thinking about your technique. You're not thinking about any. You're just playing the guitar or whatever instrument it is.
So let me ask you this. When you were playing through chord changes, though, how did you know what to do without having this theoretical base? I'm shocked that you're completely self-taught. Mm-hmm. How did you know how to play through chord changes?
That's a good question. I don't know how I know how to play the guitar. Okay, so let's say there's some chord changes going along and you ask me to sing over the top of it.
Right.
Right, scat something. I can do that.
Sure.
I can do that easy. There's nothing to it. You just scat. And when you hear the change, you scat on that bit of change. And you might have to wait for the change to go by. Or if you think it's going to be really obvious, you can anticipate it and you'll sing something that leads in and through that change. But
So somehow you just transferred that. You did it the same way as you'd sing. You just said, okay, well, these are the notes I'd want. But it didn't come in a second.
I don't even think of that. See, I don't even think of the notes I want. I don't think.
Right.
I just don't think. I just play.
Yes. And
God knows how that works. I mean, I've had a guitar in my hand all my life, so I guess that's something to do with it. But I mean, if you tell me, you know, this is some sort of mode I'm supposed to play, and I won't know what you're talking about.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I know how to play chords. I've got quite a good understanding of chords, and I've got a good understanding of arranging because, you know, I have a Pro Tools rig here. I can input things, and then I can input harmonies to the string line I've written. I can bring the brass in and get the brass to do things. You know, I can do all that stuff. That's not difficult for me. Sorry, that sounds arrogant. It's not difficult
because it sounds
so obvious, you know, how you do it. Because harmony is something that I know intuitively. I mean, I know how to – you sing me a line and I'll probably find a harmony for it first time. And if not, it won't take me long before I can sing a harmony to what you're doing. It just – I just have that. I don't know why I have it.
No, I totally
You probably got it too.
Yeah, I do. I just have a harder time, and maybe I'm thinking too much because what you're saying is a very good possibility. I'm thinking about – and I'm not like this in my life as far as like rules. I'm quite a rule breaker, to be honest with you. But when I pick up the guitar, I sort of feel like, I need to do – there's a magic spell here that I need to follow, and maybe I need to just dislodge that from my thinking or start exploring that, you know?
Yes, start exploring. I tell you what, here's something to do is just put some music on. It's not too difficult, so don't give yourself a hard time. Some music on and just jam along with it without thinking what key it's in. Don't even look for the key. Just play. Just jam along with the track. Okay. And see what happens. See where you go. See where your hands take you.
You know, I have to do that.
But this is, I suppose this, I mean, I don't know how, well, I've probably been able to do this since I was in my late 20s. So I've been doing this my whole life. So it feels particularly natural to me. If you put me on the stage and you set up my rig with a band I've never played with before and say, take a solo, I'll be fine. I'll be fine. I don't know why, but I will.
I think to some extent too, there's a confidence issue related to the amount of neck time. So I think that's what's going on in my head, because you know, I'm just thinking as you're saying, Jeff Beck works on cars. I'm pretty confident that he never sat. You know, he didn't go to a class on how to take apart an engine. He just did it and did it and did it, and you got enough time doing that, you kind of just know how things work.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I bet you're right.
And so
you might read a magazine or so, but yeah
right.
And Jeff is one of those people that's, I said to him, because I know Jeff quite well, and that thing he does with the harmonics, you know, where he'll hit a harmonic and then he'll use the wang bar to play a melody. I said, how do you do that? And he said, I've no idea.
That's awesome. You know, it's funny. I interviewed two of his guitar players. I interviewed Jennifer Batten, who was with him for 3 years. And I interviewed Carmen, the younger gal, who was with him for two or three albums ago, for a year.
Yeah.
And I said to them, well, especially Jennifer, she went to Musicians Institute, brilliant woman, a great guitarist, extremely innovative. And I said, how does Jeff do that? And she said, Craig, I watched him on stage every night for 3 years and I have no idea. This is a thing he has clearly, that it's just his thing that he owns, and man, he does it wonderfully, you know.
Oh, he came on tour with the Stewart Band he was supposed to do a whole tour, which would have been about 3 or 4 months, and he lasted about, I don't know, 8 or 10 gigs. But he came to the rehearsals, and the rehearsals were fun, really fun, and we'd hang out a lot. And he did this thing where he was doing this thing, and I said, oh, Jeff, that's amazing. Show me how you do that. So he said, well, you do this. You do 16th notes with your thumb going up and down, with your thumb. And then you play these rhythmic things with the rest of your fingers over these chords. And so you go, I said, okay, that's good. Okay. So then I went off and I started doing the 16th notes with my thumb. And I think I can probably do that for about a second and a half.
Yeah. That's, I don't understand how he does that. Yeah. It's like he's got a built-in pick in his thumbnail or something.
Unbelievable what he does. Yeah, unbelievable. But he's a beautiful guy. I like him a lot.
Very cool, man. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. What's your favorite guitar to play, and what other two or three or four guitars would round up, you know, behind them?
Well, I mentioned the old D18 that I bought new in probably 71, something like that.
Oh, wow. 250 pounds is a lot of money back in 71.
I was a fortune, yeah. It'd be the same sort of thing as, you know, 2,000 quid now.
Yeah.
You know, it was every penny I had. But somebody very kindly broke into the van and stole my Gibson J50, which was not a very nice guitar. It was okay, but it wasn't very nice. And so I was forced to, you know, save up and go and get a Martin. I always wanted a Martin. And I went to every music shop in London and the home counties with my, you know, my wedge of pound notes to find the ultimate Martin guitar, and I found it. And everybody who plays it goes, good God, what's this?
Yeah, and it's like, what, close to 40 years old now.
Yeah.
So it must sound beautiful.
It's a beauty, yeah, but it's always been beautiful. And it's very light. It's the sound box is exceedingly light. Now, the other guitar is one that I've had now for ages. It's a 1964 Fender Stratocaster. That's my other go-to guitar. And then I suppose the third one after that would be this Anfield, which is the guitar made for him by my friend, Tom Anfield, who's a luthier in England. Mm-hmm. And that's the one with the clever pickups on it, and the piezo on it. And it's also got kind of stacked, it's got Strat pickups, and then there's another level underneath which turns it into a, I don't know if it's underneath, side by side, I suppose. It turns it into humbuckers. Great. So it's got humbuckers, Strats, and piezo. And it's a beautiful guitar. I really like the sound of it. So those are my three, and I'm really low on guitars these days.
Wait a minute. That's relative or relative.
No. Well, I think I've got 13 or 14 guitars.
Wow, that is low.
Yeah, I mean, I've had loads. I've had every guitar you can possibly want to have, and then I had them all. I had a room in my house in LA with all these guitars all lined up in cases, and they were sitting there and sitting there and sitting there and sitting there and everything. And I thought, you know what? But this is bollocks.
Yeah,
I hardly ever play them. I need some really good recording equipment. So I sold all of them in one go and bought some really good recording equipment, and it served me really well.
Great.
So I have much more, because, excuse me, I'm not shy about making records. I know how to make records, you know. I have a Pro Tools rig in my house, and I can make records right here where I'm sitting at the moment. And there's always been that. I've always had a studio in my house. A small, you know,
sure.
Project studio.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're going to be a songwriter, you can't wait to, you know, somebody else to help you make the bloody thing. You've got to do it yourself.
Absolutely.
So I've had computers since the Commodore, you know, 64.
Wow.
And an Atari, you know, with all that stuff on it, and running SimpliTrack with an 8-track. Fostex and all that stuff, and so I know how to do all that, and now I'm running, you know, Pro Tools on a Mac. But I'm quite you know, for an old guy, I'm kind of computer savvy.
Yeah, it sounds it.
And that's where I got rid of these guitars. You know, I had every guitar you can think of. You know, Les Pauls, Tellys, 53 Esquire.
Oh, wow.
You know, 335s, 345s, every kind of Martin you can imagine, Dobros, what do you call it, Guilds, Gretches. I had a fantastic Gretsch Country Gentleman, a Black Beauty, you know, Fretless Wonder, black with gold fittings, you know, that Les Paul. That is a Matus. He was, and one of your questions is about, did you regret any of the? I regret getting rid of the Zematus.
Yeah, did you ever sell a guitar you wish you can get back?
Yeah, that's the one.
The Zematus.
Yeah, and it's who's that really really famous actor that was married to Jennifer Aniston? You know, the really handsome
Brad
guy.
Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt's got it.
Oh, he's got it.
Yeah,
that's really funny, man. Brad, if you're listening, Jim would like his Zematus back.
I'd like it back, please.
Yeah, man. Very cool.
No, I sold it one time when I was having some financial troubles with my American wife. We started a company that needed, you know, it ate all the cash we had.
Yeah.
And to keep it afloat, I said, well, I'll just get rid of this guitar. You know, it's a great guitar, and it had patent applied for pickups on it, 59, which I got off of 59 Gibson. And but it didn't sound as great as I'd hoped. You know, it was really, really good, but not fantastic. And, you know, I ended up I can get every sound I need to get pretty well out of a 64 Strat, you know. You just got to, you know, if you wind the amp up a bit louder than if it's a Les Paul, you know.
What do you play out of amp-wise for the most part?
I just have a Fender. I have a Fender, Fender Deluxe.
Mm. From the 60s?
A reissue.
Oh, okay.
It's okay. You know, I've had all sorts of amps too, Marshalls and Ampegs and boogies. And this is quite a nice little workhorse amp. You know, it sounds great. You know, I got one as a back line when I was doing a gig somewhere, and, you know, you fly in and they've supplied the back line, and I loved it. It's such a great tone. I thought, hey, let's have one of those. That'll do.
Oh, very cool, man.
Yeah.
Desert Island Discs.
Okay. Right. Desert Island Discs. Let me think. Favorite songs, Desert Island Discs. I think somewhere out at the top of that would be Stay With Me Baby by Lorraine Ellison.
Hmm.
I love that song. It just does it to me every time. And then I think one of the more influential tunes in my life was John Coltrane's Favorite Things.
Beautiful song.
Yeah. And his delivery is just, you know, that was part of that. One of those questions you wanted to ask about influences that would be surprising. And that would be Coltrane.
Who else?
Well, Django Reinhardt, of course, but that's not surprising.
No.
And of course, in the early days, it was, you know, Duane Eddy and the Ventures and Hank Marvin of the Shadows. And
did you meet those guys? I'm sure you must have played with Hank Marvin.
Yeah, I met Hank Marvin. I never played with him. I played with the other guy in that band, Bruce Welch. I played with him once. But Hank I met a couple of times. There's this big TV show in England called Top of the Pops.
Oh, sure.
And Cockney Rebel were on at the same time as the Shadows. And we're going into the bar, and Hank's got his guitar case with him. And I think we'd met before. I'm not quite sure, but anyway, I was a huge fan, as everybody was. He was the guitar god in his kind of Buddy Holly glasses. And I said, what you got in there, Hank? And he said, the Strat. Can I have a look at it? stop there in the corridor, right, and just bit outside the bar, and crouched down on the floor and opened up the case, and in it was this white Strat with gold fittings on it. And I said, oh my god, I said, Frank, and some Hank, can I just, you know, he said,
you're like doing a sales job. You're getting a shy, it's called a shy yes. You just get one yes, then you don't ask the whole thing in the beginning. Incremental yeses, man.
And he let me take it out of the case and hold it, and, you know, play a couple of notes on it and everything. And that was, of course, I mean, Jeff Beck will tell you, everybody loved Hank Marvin. He was the guitar god. And he was a beautiful player. He still is. Yeah. Beautiful player. That pure, sweet tone, everything incredibly accurate. No, you know, very, very well played.
Yeah.
And a lovely guy. Lovely guy. Anyway, so. Where does that leave us?
Oh, Lorraine Ellison, Coltrane, Favorite Things. Any other favorites?
Oh, I don't know. It's so hard. It's so hard. I mean, James Taylor, Randy Newman.
So you don't listen to a lot of guitar?
No.
Interesting.
No.
Very interesting.
No, I like Gary Clark Jr. My son turned me on to Gary Clark Jr. He's a nice player. I like him.
Yeah, he is.
He's got, you know, he's nice and rough and strong and forceful. And, of course, you know, I don't. I think if I was to listen to guitar players, I'd be listening to Django Reinhardt.
If like, who was your favorite player from back in the classic rock days?
Eric, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think Eric.
Which Eric? Cream Eric?
Oh, Eric Clapton. Yeah. Eric
no,
Clapton,
no, no, no. Yeah. Cream Eric or Strat Eric? Which one?
Oh God, I don't know. Well, I used to go and see the Yardbirds play at the Crawdaddy Club in
Richmond.
Oh, my
God. Wow.
You know, when I was at school.
Wow. That's so freaking cool.
So he was playing a Telecaster in those days. And that'll do, you know, that period. He's a great guitar player. He's got that thing, too, that I love. He's so economical.
Yes.
You know, I've had moments when I've seen Eric a lot of times. I've had moments where, one in particular, I went to the Forum to see him play, and I didn't really like the band. I liked his English band better. I don't really like who's that bass player he uses?
Nathan East?
Yeah, Nathan Easton. I don't really like Nathan Easton's choice of notes. I mean, I know he's a great player and all the rest of it, but that doesn't influence me that much. But I used to like it better when he had Henry Spinetti playing drums and Dave Bronze, the bass player. I've played with Dave Bronze a few times. My God, he's unbelievable. He doesn't do – he does hardly nothing.
Have you ever played with
– so great.
Sorry, I apologize.
Go on.
Have you ever played with Guy Pratt?
Oh, yeah, yeah. God, he's a wonderful bass player.
I have him coming on this show like Friday this week. He's also funny as hell.
Oh, yeah. He was doing stand-up, wasn't he, at one point?
He was just like...
Just to amuse himself. Yeah. Like, oh, he's great. Say hello from me.
I will. He was a bit of a nutter. He'd come on because I was telling him about my wife got this real cheap flight. So he goes, get your wife in here right now. I want to find out how did she get... So I had to bring my wife in here. And they're talking about... And he goes, well, if you use these miles, you can get anything. And they're like comparing that because she's going over like soon to visit her mom. So it was just quite funny. It was like...
Yeah, he's a great bass player. Fantastic.
What's the best decision you've ever made?
Picking up the guitar.
That's great.
That's an easy one. That was definitely the best decision I ever made. It's given me a lifetime of joy. It is the constant in your life. Music and being able to play the instrument is... it's food, drink, sleep, life itself, you know, being able to be a musician and live the kind of life I've led. It's I'm so privileged. I thank God every day that I have this life, that I can make a living playing music and writing songs. I mean, so fortunate.
And you've put out, as much as the humility that you have, you've put that out in your music, which is really, really wonderful, man. So, I mean, I'm happy for you. What's the most important things you've learned about yourself through your journey through life?
Something I learned about myself, don't take things too seriously. There's a lot of things you can mess yourself up with, when you're interacting in a band, you know, because unless you're going to be Ed Sheeran and just go out there with a looping pedal or two and a guitar, which God bless him, I've got so much time for him. He was so brave. But other than that, you're going to be interacting with other people, right? So first of all, it's not all about you. Even if you're the band leader, it's not all about you. You've got to give room for you've got to treat your fellow musician with respect and love. And you can expect them to be professional, but as one of my friends so wisely said, you can't shout somebody into being more talented.
Yeah, man. You can't shout somebody into doing anything, pretty much.
No. Shout them into tears.
Yeah, right. It's about tears. It.
Or you can shout them into getting a punch on the nose.
Yeah.
But no. So, the thing that goes along with that is casting. It's more important that the musicians that you work with, first of all, they have to reach a certain standard. Otherwise, they'll drive you nuts. Mm. So they've got to be able to, you know, I was watching this basketball thing and they're saying, you know, pro basketball, it's a given that you've got talent.
Sure.
It's a given. So for me to work with people, it's a given that they've got talent. Then after that, it's all about what they're like. It's all about how much fun they are, what kind of attitude they have to the work, you know, because sometimes, you know, something will go wrong and you're stuck in some place you weren't supposed to be stuck in. And what you want is people who can laugh at it and not complain and grumble. You know, when I was Rod's band leader, I came up with this really great idea, which I could pass on to anybody else who's a band leader, right? Because people were started, you know, long tours, people start to complain, you know, they complain about the food, they complain about the you know, whatever they want to complain about, right? So I invented what was called the moaning hour, right? Which you're only allowed to moan between the hours of 5 and 6, okay? And of course, anybody who's been on the road a lot knows that sound check is usually about 4:30 till maybe 5:30. Half past five, you go back to the hotel, you get cleaned up, you have a shower, you might have a nap, you have a bowl of soup or whatever, and you get ready because you're going to be on stage at 8 or 8:30. So The moaning hour, which is between five and six or six and seven, is the time when nobody's around.
Yeah,
everybody's
you're on
in
your
their
own.
Room.
Yeah, you're on your own there.
So the only way you can moan is if you call somebody up and moan down the telephone to them.
That's
but
great.
It's so easy because they can just say, I'm getting another call and hang up.
Man, that's great.
In one fell swoop, I got rid of people grumbling on the road. And if somebody would start to moan about something, I'd say, look, I'd love to listen to this, and I really understand you have a complaint, but, you know, it's actually only 2 o'clock.
Moaning hour is 5 to 6, as you know.
As you know.
That's great, man. Yeah, that's great. Very good. Good thinking, man. Yeah.
So lots of amusement about that. And of course, eventually everybody realized that, you know, moaning is really dull, and so they didn't do it.
Yeah, yeah. No, complaining doesn't really help the situation. Yeah, for sure.
No, it doesn't. No, the quality of the people, what they're like as human beings, and how well you can get on with them, what kind of sense of humor they've got and all that stuff is so important. I can't stress it. Because if you're an arsehole, I don't care how great you are, nobody wants to work with you.
Yeah. Well, I hear that all the time of, you know, people aren't necessarily hired for their talent. They're hired for their ability to get along because you got 23 hours where you're just doing that. And if you're not skilled at that, you know, because most guys would play for free for the hour and a half just out of the sheer joy. But it's the other time putting up with all the bullshit, the traveling, the this, the that, the practice and the rehearsals. That's where the stress is.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the other things that goes along with that is don't do post-mortems after the gig. If you have to have a post-mortem, have it the next day. Never do it after the gig. After the gig, just laugh at if it was really bad mistakes, laugh at them, you know, and say, oh, well, you know, we'll sort that out later, and then sort it out the following day at soundcheck. And don't ever go off on somebody because they made a mistake. They already have beaten themselves up 50 times more than you can. You know, you've got to be very light. You've got a very light touch with people on that department.
Thank you. That is really good advice for a lot of people. This has been like a combination of interview, music lesson, you know, musical director instruction. This is good, Jim. This is good.
Oh, dear. Go on. Yeah.
Who's had the biggest influence on you musically and then also personally?
The people who have had the most influence on me really are my siblings, my brother and sister. My brother was the one that introduced me to jazz. Hmm. And my sister introduced me to how to be kind. I think she's a very, very kind. We're all of Irish blood. I'm 96% Irish or Celtic and 4% Viking of all things.
Wow.
Apparently somebody had the DNA done. She taught me so many things about kindness, forgiveness, generosity, and also she's the matriarch of our tribe. And, you know, wherever there's going to be a family gathering, she'll be at the heart of it. And that kind of thing. So I became really good at being social. I'd have dinner parties and have all my mates around. And if people were coming into town, they could stay in my house. I'd put them up somewhere. If I didn't have enough rooms, they'd sleep on the living room floor, you know, anything. That kind of point of view about generosity, she taught me that. My brother introduced me to forms of music that weren't the mainstream, and that was hugely helpful. As for musical influences, I guess, you know, I learned from listening to records, so the usual suspect, you know, the blues guys, B.B. King, you know, Freddie King, and the writers, Buddy Holly, the Beatles, Gershwin. I mean, I've got a very, very wide taste.
Yeah.
Very huge, sure. You know, from Schubert to Nirvana. Yeah.
Very cool. And you see your brother and sister frequently, or are they close by?
All the time.
That's great.
All the time, yeah.
That's really nice.
My brother's walking distance.
Oh, man, that is awesome.
Both walking distance from here, yeah.
That's great.
It's a small town.
That's great.
Yeah, we've all come home. My brother spent 30 years in the United Arab Emirates in the oil business. Sort of associated with the oil business, and my sister was the one that never left home. She kept the solid roots here in Dorset, and Morris and I lived on opposite sides of the world at one point, 12 time zones away from LA.
Wow.
Is the United Arab Emirates.
That's nice, yeah. Man. I'm happy for you. That's great.
Yeah, it's good. I've got a great life at the moment. I'm very happy about it. Really happy.
You have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Well, I've got a 13-year-old daughter who takes up loads of my time. I'm happy to say, great. And we do boating. We have two or three little boats. Little boats like a kayak and a little rib kind of thing with an outboard on it that we can muck about with. We've got a little sailboat. We've got a paddleboard.
Oh, those are cute.
So we've got all these little things, little toys that we play on the river, and then we go down, as I said, to go down to the beach, and there's the ocean. I mean, it's
it's really cool.
Man, this is all right. This is really all right.
It's funny when we went. I think I was in England. I guess in 2000 around there, and we went to Cambridge. Cambridge College over there, and they had this canals right in the back, man, and it was so gorgeous.
Oh yeah, it's the Cam.
Yeah, right. It was just so gorgeous. I remember looking at that. It's different than what we have here. So I think, obviously when something's pretty and different, it's like takes on another dimension of beauty, nice.
Yeah, it's Cambridge is a fantastically beautiful town architecturally.
Yeah,
same as Oxford. We've got loads of that kind of stuff. I mean, it's an old country.
Favorite place you've traveled, Jim?
The Seychelles, maybe. The Seychelles Islands in the Indian Ocean, they're really beautiful. And Thailand, I like that kind of culture too. But then, cities, you've got to do a lot of traveling before you can beat Paris. So Paris is what I think. If I didn't live in England, I would want to live either in Paris or maybe in the countryside in Tuscany in Italy. Italy is so beautiful too. I mean, this is one of the things I missed when I was living in California. You can, in an hour on a plane, you can be in somewhere quite wonderfully different, or an hour and a half, from Greece to Scandinavia to Portugal to Croatia, Prague, all these ridiculously old cultures that you can just drop yourself right into for however long you want to stay.
Yeah.
Whereas I found, an hour on a plane in out of LA and you're in Bakersville.
Or Vegas, but and it's not. Yeah,
Vegas. Vegas.
It's not. I get what you're saying because that's what I always find fascinating when I go over there and visit. My mother-in-law. It's so from an hour away, like you're saying, it's dramatically different. Different language, different culture, different architecture, different topography. It's really amazing. Whereas in the States, it's like pretty similar culturally, maybe some different sites, but it's not dramatically different.
First of all, it's all the same language, somewhat of the same culture.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't get me wrong, I've had some wonderful experiences in America. I'm very fond of the American people. They've been treated me so well in so many odd, wonderful, strange cases where I'd be on the road and meet some people and go back to their house and hang out and be treated great. And loads and loads of fun. Los Angeles is not a great town to grow old in. Mm. It's a place to go and grab the money and run. But there's so many other wonderful places like New Orleans and where you are.
St. Pete's pretty relaxed down here. St. Pete is beautiful.
Chicago's a great town. New York, Boston. There's loads of great places. Just LA is not one of them for me.
Sure.
There's too much bullshit. Everybody's in the entertainment business. Your taxi driver's in the entertainment business. Your accountant's in the entertainment business. Nobody's doing a real job. Well, your waitress is an actress.
Your accountant's in the entertainment business.
Oh, yeah, I know. Accountant was a bloody Bruce Springsteen impersonator on the weekends. Oh,
my God. That's too funny.
I was
like,
what's going on? And everybody's written a script. Sold off with your script.
Yeah, I think today, with the internet and quote celebrity, it's just everybody feels that I don't know, man. Everybody wants to be a celebrity or something like that, you know, or be, quote, famous, whatever that means. So,
as you know, for having interviewed, I guess, loads and loads of musicians, that has never been, that's never the driving force.
Never. It's never. Literally never. Never. In fact, for most people, it's like, well, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a rock star. And then I realized that's not likely to happen, but I wanted to play music. And then, so I did, you know, plan B, C, D, and E, or whatever that was, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, last question. And man, I cannot thank you enough. You're just a lovely guy, man. And
oh, my pleasure. I've had a great time chatting with you. It's been fun.
Very cool, man. Me too. Biggest change in your personality, Jim, over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional and how much is just a natural part of aging?
I don't think anything that the aging process, I'm not one of those people that deliberates over things. My father gave me some really good advice. He said, "No, Jimmy, listen, son, if worrying will earn you a dollar, worry like hell."
Oh man, that is great. You did the accent down and everything, man.
Yeah. So that's just something that stayed with me. I really do try not to worry about stuff because first of all, it tires you out. It's bad for you. And it really doesn't do anything at all, especially the stuff that you can't do anything about. I've got more comfortable in my skin, if you wish. Mm-hmm. And I figured out, you know, at long last, that happiness is something that you carry inside you. And you apply that to all the circumstances in your life, or to some degree or another. I mean, that's going to be the very best is if you can apply the happiness that you carry with you to everything in your world. But of course, we're human. You're never going to be able to pull that one off. That'd be a great trick if you could do it. You'd be living on a mountaintop, floating 4 feet above the ground. but I understand that. I understand that, and I understand that. Various things happened to me in my life financially that gave me a huge – some disastrous financial things happened, right? So I had to start over sort of in my 50s, having lost, you know, the homes and all the rest of it. I don't want to go into the details of how that happened. But and I realized that – so much of the stuff, a bit like the guitars, you know, how many guitars do I need? Well, I don't even need the 13, 14 guitars I've got. I only really need three, a 12 string, a 6 string, and a Strat. You know, off you go. That'll do. And my life is quite simple, but I really, really enjoy it. I don't have a lot of stuff. I don't have a lot of needs and desires. I mean, I still have some beautiful clothes. I have a nice car. I have, you know, some bits and pieces left over from my glory days when I was at the, you know, driving Ferraris and traveling on Concorde. You know, those times are gone, but I don't miss them at all. And I don't envy the people that do have them. I find I'm really content. And I think that is maybe the function of age. And maybe a tiny bit of wisdom has crept in that I'll be 73 next month. So maybe a tiny bit of wisdom's crept in. But I still could put on an electric guitar and I still play like a madman. And I imagine I'm still 18. It's the fountain of youth playing the music.
Jim, I got goosebumps when you said that, man. That was great. For every single thing you said, thank you, man. It was really cool. Especially, I like when you said happiness is something you carry inside of you. It doesn't come from outside. So I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, man.
No, thanks. Thank you.
Man, you're awesome. And I cannot thank you enough. Let me tell people some of the things you have going on now. And Jim's got a really cool band, Cregan & Company, Cregan & Co. His last name is spelled Cregan, C-R-E-G-A-N. And he's got a couple of singles out. And I would encourage you to check those out. Give them a listen. They're called Shane and Don't Listen. And also, you have a single with Bernie. What was that?
That's the one. The one I wrote with Bernie Taupin is a thing called Shane.
Oh, that's Shane. Okay.
We wrote it for Roy Orbison. And unfortunately, as you know, he passed away before we could get it to him.
Sure.
You'll see, it sounds like it. If you can imagine Roy Orbison singing it, then there you go. It's like that. We were all Roy Orbison fans.
And did you want to say something about your charity?
Well, yes. You've already covered the bit about what the idea of the charity is.
Yes.
It's the idea that we can't really sit back and let 20 people kill themselves every day because they're not getting the attention they need, or that there's some now very interesting new techniques for brain waves. I could go into the details of it because I think I understand it, but there are treatments that can help you take the depression out of your system. This is something that we're trying to build these clinics that can do that. Anyway, I wrote a song with these guys, The Side Deal, and it's called "The One That Got Away," and the money goes to this charity, Angel Force USA. So check it out. It's "The One That Got Away." It's The Side Deal with Jim Cregan. And if you download it, which would be the best way to put money in the charity, it's 95 cents or something like that. And that's your contribution. You'll be helping.
Awesome.
These veterans.
That's fantastic.
Thank you so much.
No, I'll do that. Come on, a buck to help these guys. Are you kidding me? That's a great. You're doing, man. You raised 200 grand in the first show. That's. I just hope you come down here or somewhere near here that I go see you. That would be phenomenal.
We're taking it all over the place. Wish us luck. It's in its infancy. We're all committed to doing it. I found, these two charities now that I'm involved with, the prostate cancer and this one. And the people that I'm working with on this are really wonderful people, fantastic people. So I'm going to run away now and take my daughter to rugby.
What?
But I've got to say, it's been fantastic talking with you, Craig, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell all these stories on the radio.
Man, you're the best. It was my pleasure. Hang on 1 minute. It's going to wrap up. Everybody, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support with this. Thanks very much to Jim Cregan for spending time with us. Check out his music. Please also go look at his charity, the song called "The One That Got Away," and the charity is called Angel Force USA. And look at supporting that. And make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.